Hey guys, thank you so much for tuning in to this week's episode of Unbox. But before we get into the episode, I want to talk about our brilliant new sponsor, Comey. I first discovered Comey on Jamie Lang, Idris Elba and Addison Rae's socials. So I quickly asked the team to get in touch because what they are doing is truly groundbreaking. What's apparent about Comey is that they truly believe in the creator space and they are very passionate about helping creators to maximize their results online. Comey empowers creators, musicians, and athletes to create their own personalized landing page, acting as their link in bio, allowing all of their content to be in one centralized location. Comey provides an incredibly easy-to-use drag-and-drop tool, which allows you to create your own personalized hub in 5 minutes. Check out unbox.comey.io for an example, or Gwen Stefani's, or Idris Elba's, or any other of your favorite celebrities, because they have everyone right now. It allows you to share with your followers the things that they may not have seen. For example, if you're posting a YouTube video, they may not have seen your book, or your live tour, or your merch. Now it's all in one central location. Comey is the link in bio 2.0, and I'm so excited for you to check it out. Later on in the series, you'll hear from two of the co-founders, Lewis and Ben, who have onboarded over 1 billion followers in under a year. That is truly staggering. Comey is a platform that I couldn't recommend highly enough. So if you want to up your link in bio game this year, head to comey.io for more. That is K-O-M-I.io.
Listen.
This week on Unboxed, I'm joined by Toni Tone. She's best known for her Twitter commentary and authoring books such as her bestseller, I Wish I Knew This Earlier, Lessons on Love. Toni's advice and guidance has been essential for many of her followers, and she is always either involved in the latest social conversation or sparking the next movement of debate around love, life, and social narratives. She's one of the internet's big sisters, best friends, and for some, the greatest reality check. Let's get into it with Toni. Toni, thank you so much for coming on Unboxed. So much of your world, I've been digging into it for a while now and love everything that you do. Thank you. Of your world is around giving advice and supporting people.
Yeah.
Have you always wanted to support other people?
I kind of like naturally fell into it, to be completely honest with you. So I think like being the eldest sibling of like an immigrant family, I was used to leading and helping others. So whether it's like helping my parents with certain things, helping my siblings with certain things. So I've always been an advice giver by default, but just in a familial sense, right? And I got to a stage in life where I was going through certain things and I was like, oh my God, who do I talk to? And I couldn't think of who to reach out to because I was so used to being the advice giver that I kind of just went online and was like, you know what? I will try and help myself through sharing advice online in the hopes that I kind of like unbox what I want to, you know, do and how I want to move forward. And then in doing that, people were like, oh my God, this is so helpful. Oh my God, I'm in the same situation. And I was like, wait, oh, I'm trying to help myself. I'm using this as like an online journal, but I'm still helping other people in the process. And then from there, I said, okay, this is really fulfilling. I want to do this.
Yeah. And what platform is that specifically? Twitter?
Twitter, yeah.
Yeah, good old Twitter. Yeah. and how did you find sort of being so vulnerable on such a scale? And when did it get to the point where you're like, wow, there's not just like a few people here, there's a lot?
Being vulnerable, admittedly, has been quite easy for me. I come from a family that is very transparent. We talk about like everything and anything. So it's not like a foreign concept for me. I was born into that kind of environment where you talk about your feelings, you have a family meeting. So that was quite easy. I guess it was difficult when I would say something and I'm talking about my personal experience and then people would project or misconstrue or totally twist what I was trying to say. And that's when I was like, okay, this is bigger than me just using Twitter as a stream of like consciousness. Mm. I have to be very mindful of how I articulate myself because it's going out into the world wide web. Like thousands, sometimes even millions of people will see my content.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, being vulnerable is easy. But what was harder was ensuring that you articulate it in the most effective way possible.
Yeah. And what were the lessons that you learned in that? Like, what were the moments where you're like, wow, okay, this just needs to shift a little bit?
I learned that it's not every conversation you need to give your 2 cents in. Like, there was one time I remember, like, I think everyone who's quite prominent on Twitter has been through like a dragging, right? There was one time
it's a rite of passage, I think, for most people.
Yeah, it's literally a rite of passage. I went through like my dragging where people, well, I say people, it was mostly men that were dragging me for spoiling their fun. And I didn't even write anything controversial, but they were like joking about women and hair extensions and fake hair. And I kind of like shared my 2 cents and I was like, ladies, don't mind them. They're just being silly because they're celebrity crush has extensions. They'll say one thing one day, they'll chase the girl with the extensions the next day, like, really don't care. And the boys were like, here she comes again, Miss Feminist ruining our fun. And so I guess that taught me that, you know what, some conversations aren't that deep. Like, people are like roasting others sometimes on social media for fun, and they're having like their like funny gender wars or whatever. Like, I do not have to add my two cents in a serious way every single time. And another key lesson was really like understanding the value of the word some and sometimes.
Mm. Non-generalizing.
Exactly. Yeah. Because you can write a statement and in your mind, it's common sense. It doesn't apply to everybody, but people are very literal. Like, literal is a black and white world. And if you say, men need to do a better job at blah, 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 like, everybody would be offended. So you could say, some men need to do a better job. It
saves everything.
It saves everything. So the value of some and sometimes to ensure I don't generalize, key lessons.
Okay. And what's your view of somebody who has obviously been so vulnerable, so honest and open with everything and has had to learn how to non-generalize, how to be careful with how you speak and so on? What's your view on the kind of Twitter cancel mob and the culture that can sometimes arise where that dragging can be really detrimental when people often don't really maybe mean to say something in a certain way, as you just said, right? It can be accidental. What's your view on that whole thing?
I hate mass dragging. I think that people can be very quick to want to argue online without actually sitting back and considering nuance. People don't always apply common sense. People want to take everything literally. And I think it's because they just want someone that they can just let their frustrations out on. So I'm anti all of that. And as far as like cancel culture, like, people go through all that. And it's not even, to me, cancel culture, is it really real? Mm. Really? Like,
someone maybe else said that.
Maybe recently. If you're a black woman, like, the intersectionality of your race and gender makes it very easy for people to cancel you. But when do men really get cancelled out here for real, especially if you're not a person of color? Like, are you really getting cancelled for saying certain things? Like, I also noticed that online, we give certain people way more grace than other people.
Yeah.
And also, like, people don't consider growth. I hate it when someone will bring up a tweet that another person wrote when they were 13 years old. The person's what, 27 now? And oh my God, you said this at 13. It's like, yes, it was a vile thing to say at 13. Mm. But
I'm 27 now.
Person has grown. Yeah. Like, give them grace. So there is an absence of compassion on the app, but I try to be as compassionate as possible with the way I write for that reason.
Yeah. I mean, what's your advice to creators out there who are sort of starting out, who want to ultimately share their opinion on things, who want to talk about things, you want to have an impact on people's lives through commentary and whatnot? What would be your advice on navigating that on a personal level?
My advice would be, you will never ever have an impact in this world if you are preoccupied with how people perceive you. There has to be a willingness to let people into your thoughts, just let people in generally. There has to be an acceptance that at times you may embarrass yourself. There has to be an acceptance of the fact that you need to let go of that fear of failure. And I guess that would be my advice. If you want to have an impact, you want to share your thoughts online, let go of that fear of failure. Let go of being over preoccupied with other people and their opinions. Let go of feeling like, oh, I could embarrass myself. And you just have to let everything out, put everything on the table with the belief that what you have is valuable. Because at the end of the day, people might not like what I say. People might criticize me for what I do, but I truly believe that what I do is of value. And you need to believe that, because as long as you believe that, it will inform everything you decide to do moving forward. Like, yes, I might irritate 10 men with my tweet about men being more romantic, there are some men with my tweet about men being more romantic and the value in doing that. But then there are like 100 women who are like, I'm so grateful that you wrote this. I'm going to share this with my husband because I've been trying to explain this to him. And so it's like, I know that I'm having positive impact somewhere, and that's enough.
No, wise. And another way to obviously make impact is books.
Yeah.
And you've written two.
Yes.
Both Sunday Times bestsellers.
Hopefully the third one will be.
Yeah, come on, make it happen. Tell us about the process. Writing books, when did you have the idea to write the first book? How did it all come about and what was it like?
So the first book happened not necessarily because I had an idea, but the publishing company reached out to me as a result of my writing on Twitter. So I was writing about love and relationships, and a wonderful woman called Nancy Adamora, who worked for HarperCollins, reached out to me and said, Tony, have you ever thought about writing a book. And I was like, I'd never thought about it, but it makes sense because all I do is write online. Like, why not put it into a book?
I mean, how many words have you written on Twitter through the years? How many tweets have you done? I always find that number like staggering and like...
I don't want to know. I don't know. And I don't want to know because I feel like I'll read it and just be like, Tony, what are you doing 24/7? So she was like, do you want to write a book? And I was like, oh my God, I would love to. So I gave her like an overview of like what my idea was and she loved it. She was like, yes, I think this would be perfect. Fantastic. So I basically wrote like a guide effectively on navigating love and relationships based on my experience. And it's called I Wish I Knew This Earlier. And that was the one that became a Sunday Times bestseller. And the process for that was relatively straightforward because I had spent so much of my life writing about that topic online. So I kind of just took all the things that I had written online, put them into this book and elaborated on them and added some extra things as well. So that was fantastic. That was easy and straightforward. Mm. The process did shock me a tiny bit though, because in my mind, having not been in that industry before, I thought I would like write something and then the editor would come and just like add all this pizzazz and magic and just like make it a million times better. And to realize my editor was really just checking for like grammatical errors, spelling errors, and the odd factual error. And I had to write the whole thing myself. Like 99.9% was all me. I was like, oh, so there is no special person who comes and just writes the rest of me. Like, wow, I thought that was like a thing.
Yep.
And apparently it's just like a celeb biography thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, that was like a shock to the system and obviously navigating the contractual side of that. But delving into like the publishing world, I did... What's the word I'm looking for? I think that just, I don't want to say substance, because I feel like the substance has always been there, right? Whether people wanted to see it or not. But people take me more seriously now. And it's unfortunate that it had to get to that point. I had to write a book and become a Sunday Times bestseller for people to take me seriously.
Yeah.
But it has helped me significantly in how brands perceive me and also in what they offer me.
Mm.
I think navigating this space can be very hard generally, but especially as a person of color and a black woman at that. And like it's proven that we generally do not get offered the same amount of money as our white counterparts when it comes to content creation. And I think just having that under my belt, like brands knew we can't step to Tony with some like...
It's a bit of a shield, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, you have to come correct. And I think like having that... accolade has changed the way people perceive my work.
Credibility, right? And
that's
legitimacy.
The word, yes. It has added some credibility to
books
what
I do. That, and I think, you know, I've seen, I worked at YMU for 4 years, big talent management company in the more sort of TV entertainment side of things predominantly. And so I see so many books and the way that a book, if done right and if authentic, can just massively level up someone's credibility. And again, it's like, should it be that way when you've been writing exceptionally online for however long?
Yeah.
But there's something about the sort of the gratification, the physical nature of a book, which just means that it adds this weight to somebody's whole brand, right? So it's so, I think it's so important for people to do if they can, if they have something valuable to say and to give, right? As you have.
And there's also the added stream of income as well.
Yeah.
Like when
they go on forever.
Yeah, literally. Long after I'm gone, hopefully people will still be buying my book. Yeah. So there's that to consider as well.
Right, let's talk about brands. So what has been your relationship working with brands through the years? What's your view on the kind of industry, if you will, of creators earning money with brands, with brand deals and so on? And what is the impact as a black female creator? Because it's a world out there, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a world. I'm quite lucky in that. Now I have like a great team at DDA who helped me with like my brand deals. But prior to having them on board, crazy. Like I was often being offered way less than I deserved. And having DDA act as middle person has changed that tremendously, because they're dealing with an official entity who negotiate on my behalf, who have access to lawyers, who have access to contracts. And if I had not had them, I know that my experience with brands would be completely different, because it was completely different. I remember when I went into DDA for my initial meeting, they asked me like what I was charging at the time, and I gave them the amount, and they kind of looked at me like,
sorry,
what?
Like, what were you charging?
Is that God, at the time, they asked me about a certain piece of content I did, and I charged £400 for it, and they said they would have charged £2,000 for it. And I was like, oh.
So
Okay.
Okay.
I'm glad I came to this meeting.
Yeah. Because they were like, we would have loved you from a client perspective because we would have got you to do work for the cheap. But now we want to manage you. Yeah, that's not going to fly. Like, so they basically said five times what I was asking for. And I was like, oh, okay.
And how did you have interest? How did you arrive at that £400 figure, for example? Like, what was your own reasoning?
It sounds ridiculous, but at the time when I was like starting the whole content creation journey, I was thinking, okay, so I earn this much in my 9 to 5. So doing a job for this much is like what I would earn in a week. Oh my God.
It's only going to take me an hour.
Yeah, and it's going to take me 1 hour. Let me ask for what I get in a week. And to me, it's like, oh my God, £400 to post a picture. That's insane. I did that in one day. And they were like, no, consider other things. And then that's when I started, when working with them, that's when I started to understand things about like exclusivity, about usage, about paid ad spend, and realizing that there are levels to this. Like, it's not just about creating content for brands. Like, where are they going to put the content? Is it, does it mean you can't work with other similar brands? Are they going to use your content for adverts? If so, how much money are they? Long? Exactly. So all that stuff was stuff that was like a new world to me. I had no clue. But I'm so lucky in that I have a team behind me who negotiate on my behalf, who help draw out contracts on my behalf, and they look through all that fine detail, because without them, I know that, I would have lost out on a lot of money.
100%. And what has been your best and your worst experience working with the brand?
Best, Facebook, because they paid me a lot of money for work that they helped me film themselves. Like, I would say that's the best, because I earned what I was earning in 1 year in my 9 to 5, I earned from a single post. But it was shocking because it's like, oh, we're gonna come to you and we're gonna film you. And I'm like, what? Wait, so what
so
work
I have to
am
stay
I
stay in my house?
Yes.
And get dressed up and you're gonna film me and I'm gonna make all this money. Great.
I'm like, I'm not even doing the work. I'm not filming. And they're like, no, we're gonna come film you. And I'm like, what are you paying me for? But then realizing there was like usage, exclusivity, and things
also
like that.
Also for you, because you, what you carry in terms of your brand, your resonance with people, your ability to connect, they're leveraging and ultimately using that to enhance their narrative and story. And that's the value, as well as your media, because you're posting it out and your media has real tangible value in it, right? Yes. And those are the bits that people don't often put two and two together, I think.
Yeah, but that's exactly it. Like, as far as like, but this is just best when it comes to the financial gain and the ease of the job.
Again, like the book, like being able to work with a brand like Facebook, like that as a lift up is huge, right?
Massive, And I think brands like Meta, brands like Samsung have been tremendous for me on that level, like adding some credibility. So that those, I think, Facebook was the best because it was just like surreal. And that was the highest paid job. I think that to date, that's the highest paid job I've ever gotten. And it was so easy. Like, there are jobs I do now that are less, that require way more work. But
for sure,
that was amazing. I remember, like, I thought my management made an error when they sent me.
So
they were like,
is that an extra zero there?
No, seriously. I said, oh, you've made a mistake. You've added the zero. They were like, no. That's, I was like, are you joking?
Okay.
So yes, so that was the best job.
Yes.
Worst. I wouldn't say I have a worst job, but I have a bad memory, but it was a job that I ended up refusing.
Okay.
So there was a particular brand and I had spoken, I'd done a project with them where I spoke during Black History Month about racism in the industry. Basically, I did that project, crickets. I would not hear from the brand forever. And then they had this like massive party. I didn't get an invite. Then Black History Month came again and they said, Tony, can you do? And I was like, excuse me? I said, pardon? And then they were like, we want you to talk about racism. And I said, no, I'm not doing it. And they were like, why? And I'm saying to my management, you are not going to use me as the token Black girl to speak on behalf of your brand only when it comes to race relations. You do not invite me to any events that you invite other influencers to.
Yeah.
You do not send me any merch that you send to other influencers. You do not engage with me in any other campaigns. But when you're looking for an articulate intellectual, as far as you're concerned,
you fit the bill.
I fit the bill.
Mm.
Everyone else is getting opportunities left, right, center. You forget about me, but when you need someone to be the face of a topic that is deemed high risk and you don't want bad press and you don't want anyone who'll say the wrong thing, you remember me when it comes to race, but it's crickets until it's Black History Month. And I was like, that goes against the very essence of what I'm speaking about. Like, on the basis of Black History Month and racism, like, you should see Black creators as more than just fillers for racial discourse. Like the fact that you engage with all your white content creators throughout the year, you only remember me when you want me to talk about race. Like, get out of here, I'm not doing it.
Almost as tokenistic as Black History Month is, in my opinion.
But it's true, literally. Yeah. And I was just like, okay, no, I'm not doing it. So that was like a bad memory because it left a really bad taste in my mouth. And I was just like, it's a shame that a brand like that at the time would do that. So yeah, I was over that. And that really emphasized a valuable lesson for me. Like, it wasn't just about working with a brand and getting a check. It's about principle as well. And I'm big on principle. Like, I don't care how much money you offer me. If it's something I don't believe in, I'm not doing it. But also, I don't care how much money you offer me. If I feel like it's tokenistic or you're using me.
Or it's exploitative.
Or the relationship is not like mutually beneficial. Like, generally, I'm not going to do it. Like, yes, I was saying no to like a high sum of money, but it was the principle. Like, you're not gonna do that to me. So that wasn't a good experience.
Okay, and what is your advice to Black female creators with navigating brands in the UK? Because I think often you hear experiences in the US, but it is different, as you've said, things like that, where you need to be aware of maybe why brands are coming to you, how they're coming to you, sensitivity tone, etc. What would be your advice to people?
This is going to sound wrong, but stop being so grateful. I think sometimes as Black creators, we're just grateful to get the job. Like, oh, thank you, I'm so grateful. And for that reason, we'll take peanuts sometimes. Like, understand your worth. Like, stop being just grateful about everything. Understand that you are actually bringing these brands value. You have something to offer, and that is why they are approaching you. And don't just accept jobs because, oh, it's a, they're paying me really, really rubbish money, but the brand is a brand that, oh, I really like, or it's really great. Like, if the brand that you really like respected you as a creator, they would pay you what you're worth. And if it's not in their budget, then articulate that.
Yeah.
And unless it's the kind of like opportunity where you feel like the impact outweighs what you have to personally gain, okay, by all means, go for it. But don't think, oh, because I love this clothing brand and I really like them and I'm just grateful for the opportunity, I'm going to take £200 to post this piece of content, even though I have 500,000 followers. Like, no, don't do it. It's the principle. And how you start is how these brands will go on with you. Another thing I would say is also consider the brand's like values, especially as a Black creator. Like, what does the brand stand for? Do they work with other creators of color? If so, in what capacity? I think that's also quite important.
Yeah, I can imagine, you know, when you have 500,000 followers, how many followers you might have, one might have, that you almost don't necessarily appreciate what that truly means in terms of media value, in terms of how you can elevate a brand's presence, their ability to talk in certain spaces, what you represent culturally is anything, right?
Yeah.
And as you're saying, Black creators give so much value to brands who want to play in certain scenes. There was always that thing around, you know, so many brands at the minute have been using a certain group of influencers and creators, and they seem to be the same across because they know they want to talk in this scene, and therefore they use these creators as their way into the scene, and you can just see it. But so many people, I don't think, are necessarily aware of that, right? It's really interesting.
So my third book is going to be a book about love and relationships as well. Hopefully I get signed off from my editor about all this, but you kind of hear it here first. Like, I've not really talked about it elsewhere. And it's a book about love and relationships, but from the lens of men, basically. So that's what I want to do next, to be that conduit, if you will, and help to give men a voice in a space where it's mostly women talking. And I think the love space is generally like female authors. So yeah, I want to write the book, but based on what men have said.
Yeah. And have you done any of that research already? Or have you done any sort of... What triggered that for you? Like, was there a conversation you had which was like, right, I need to write this book?
Do you know what? Trolls triggered it. Trolls on Twitter, because a lot of trolls will say, here she goes again, speaking for men. And it's like, I'm not speaking for men. When I say some men, I'm not speaking for you guys. But they'll be like, here she goes again, speaking for men. And I'm like, okay, cool. You think I speak for men? And I'm not actually speaking to men. I'm going to speak to them. So when I deliver what I
do.
Yes. So when I deliver what I deliver, just know a man said this. I shared it with you, but it wasn't my thought process. It was a man's thought process. And it was literally those trolls that try to diminish what I do. And I thought, you know what? To a degree, they're right. They're right. Men need to speak about these things more, but a lot of men, sadly, aren't willing. They don't want to be as vulnerable. And I understand why, because of the stigma that can sometimes be associated with men being vulnerable about love and relationships online. Men don't want to be called a simp. They don't want to be called all these negative words from sharing their like innermost feelings. So I was like, okay, I'm going to be that person who gives them the space. And I'm going to anonymize them because, again, there is that stigma there, but at least they have the opportunity to speak their mind.
Yeah.
And so next time you have an issue, I'll just be like, a man said this.
Yeah. And I mean, for you, obviously, you've got brothers, you've obviously friends with lots of men and so on. It's how important do you think it is for men to speak out about how they feel? How important do you think it is to have more men in the dialogue of love and relationships? You said it's a very female dominated space.
I think it's so important for men to speak out more. And I'm quite blessed in that the men in my life are men that have no problem with speaking out. My brother does TikToks, mostly about cars, but he talks about how much he loves his wife often. And he's done IG lives with me where he's talked about love and relationships. My boyfriend talks very openly about love and relationships. And I have a father who I can sit down with and talk very openly about love and relationships. And I've seen how their willingness to talk has also influenced the kind of relationships they have. I think that's partly because they're willing to do that self-reflection and they're willing to share when they're unhappy. They're willing to share when they are happy. And I think it's transformative to be able to speak up about your feelings, right? And I think for that reason, it serves men to share how they feel because women and men are not mind readers. It doesn't matter whether you date men, whether you date women, your partner cannot read your mind. And if you want to navigate your relationships in a certain way, if certain things upset you, the best way to articulate that is to say it, right? Mm. And I think there are a lot of men, sadly, who don't speak up about the pressures they feel in relationships, whether that's financial pressure, pressure to provide, whether that's pressure to live up to a certain standard as perpetuated by social media. Or there are men who want a certain type of relationship, but they've never articulated that I really want a partner who sees me for me, because they don't want to come across soft, if you will. Mm. And I think that's why I want to do it, because it's not only going to help us as women understand men better, if you're a woman who dates men, but it's also going to help men with the standard of their relationships.
Yeah. And also hopefully set a standard for men to feel more confident as they see other young people, other older people talk about how they feel in relationships. Yeah. Like, you need to almost, as you say, catalyze that conversation and then allow the rest to take place.
Yeah, exactly.
One thing I think is really interesting on this is like your Twitter and your conversation, your dialogue with your audience, it's probably opened you up to such a kind of sample size, if you will, of of data and of information about some of the common things that seem to always happen, right? Because I'm sure there are a lot of threads. What are some of those in the topic of love and relationships specifically? What are some of the common things that you always see in your DMs, in your comments in 2023?
Oh God, the most common things I see in my DMs, one of them is, Tony, how do I get over my ex? So everyone is in bondage to their ex, like it seems. But so that is, how do I get over my ex? That's a really common thing.
What do you say?
We'd be here forever. We'd be here forever.
What do you commonly say? Because I'm sure, again, you probably have to copy and paste answers.
Yeah. Well, one thing I say is that, like, it takes time. Like, we don't get over people overnight. I think some people think that they can be in a relationship for 5 years with someone and within 3 months they should be over them. It doesn't work like that. I think some psychologists have even said it takes half the length of a relationship to get over someone, right? So if you're with someone for a year, 6 months, 6 years, 3 years.
Yeah. So men and women get over it so differently, right?
Yes.
Like, I don't know if this is what you said, but I was in a relationship for like 4.5 years when I was like between 14 and 18, those kind of years. And I remember my girlfriend at the time, like, she, like, I think, got over it relatively quickly because she kind of let all the emotions out and kind of went through that period of almost grief, relationship, all that sort of stuff. And then I hadn't, and I sort of lingered for like probably about another year and a half, two years before I actually ended up kind of closing that off. Yeah. And it was, and so many people I've spoken to had the same thing where it's like, like I was fine, I was all good. And then, you know, I'm like, oh, no, I'm breaking down. Yeah, do you know what I mean? There are threads. I see the threads.
Yeah, that's actually one of the things I say, that you have to allow yourself. And I wrote about this in my first book, allow yourself to grieve, allow yourself to feel the emotions with the knowledge that it's a journey. Like, you're not going to get over them overnight. And you might have a day where you feel like you're over them, and then a week later, you feel like you miss them again. So allow yourself to feel those feelings. And also, like, asserting your boundaries. I think sometimes we can make things harder for ourselves because we're following our exes on social media, or we're constantly checking their page, or we're texting them about futile things. And it's like, in order for you to move on, it helps to go cold turkey and just completely shut yourself away from that memory. Mm. And it might not always be easy, and you have to communicate that, especially if you want to remain friends, but it's something you need to do. Mm. And also the awareness that there is someone out there for everybody. And I think sometimes we can be in relationships and we think that person is the only person. I'll never find anyone better. But you will never find anyone better if you do not allow yourself the freedom to move on.
Yeah, and close that off, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, but yeah, what you said is actually very relatable. So I wrote about that in my first book too, how I was in a relationship on and off for like 6.5 years. After
six
I was like,
and a half
cool.
years. Wow.
I'm fine. I'm like, it's whatever. Yeah. Da, 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 da. Then one day I was at my job. This is back when I worked a 9-to-5. And I just remember going to the bathroom and I burst into tears. And I was like,
why?
And
what
this
just
was like a year and a half after. I was like, what's going on? Why am I upset? And I realized it's because I was not trying to feel those emotions. Yeah. I was just shutting them into a box.
I think, it happened. I think, as you say, why it's so important to have these conversations, to have these books, to open up the dialogue so people can feel confident to confront those emotions and dig into that more than hiding them away and putting them in a box.
Exactly.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, so what give me two more things in your DMs and in your comments that you see from your huge sample size of the UK population.
I've never had a boyfriend and I'm X age. I've never had a boyfriend and I'm 27. Never had a boyfriend and I'm 32. Never had a boyfriend and I'm 25. Like, a lot of people thinking that there is like a timeline you should have had a boyfriend by. And that is not true. Everyone meets people at different stages of their life. And there are some people that have had boyfriends since the age of 16. Every year they've had a different boyfriend and they've never had a fulfilling relationship. So it's about telling people that, like, it's not something you should rush.
Yeah.
Do not put pressure on yourself. Do not try and ascribe to a timeline that you think is the timeline based on like societal standards or what you see in Hollywood. Like, allow yourself the opportunity to meet someone who is for you. And you don't need to have a boyfriend for having a boyfriend's sake. You have a boyfriend when you meet someone and you think, this person adds value and I want you in my life. And then in line with that, it's like, oh, I'm a virgin and I'm this age. And it's like, again, intimacy is not something you should rush for doing it's sake. You should do it when you feel comfortable.
I can, can agree more. Can agree more. If you're a young creator starting out today, what would be your one piece of advice?
In order of priorities, when it comes to what you do, your mental health should always be number one. Even if it means you have to shut your accounts down for a period of time, even if it means that you stop using certain platforms, even if it means you totally transform and change the way you navigate social media, like, you cannot do anything in life effectively if you are not in the healthiest space possible, whether that's physically or mentally. But I think particularly with social media, the mental impact can be quite significant. And you have to know your triggers, accept your strengths and weaknesses, and be very honest with yourself about how it's impacting you and whether it's impacting you negatively. And if it is, you have to take responsibility for doing something about that. So I would say, as any content creator, young creator, earning money, great. Being known, great. Having impact, great. But at the end of the day, are you happy? Are you in a good mental space? Do you like what you see when you look in the mirror? Do you like who you are? And do you feel like you can do the job effectively? So in your list of priorities, mental health is always number one.
Great. And finally, who is a creator that you're loving at the minute?
God, there are so many. Oh, can I be biased? Because this person is actually related to me. So I'm going to be biased. But I'm going to say my brother on TikTok, because my brother was never, ever a content creator. He's always had a passion for cars.
What's his handle?
Tommy Music on TikTok. Always had a passion for cars, right? Then before I know it, he went from like 1,000 TikTok followers to like 100,000+ in like months. And he has built this massive community of car lovers, just like organically from being genuinely passionate. He never sought out content creation. He never decided he wanted to be a creator. He was just talking about cars. And now, like, I go out with my brother and people are like, yo, you're Tommy from TikTok. And men are like honking like, oh, Tommy. Because they recognize his cars and stuff like when he's driving them. And I would say, like, he's someone that I've like really inspired me recently, because he's reminded me that like passion can really, really drive what you do. As long as you love what you do and you believe in it, even if you're not thinking about the numbers and if you're not thinking about the impact, it will organically occur because you genuinely love what you do.
And that's infectious, right?
It's so infectious. And just seeing the way his account has grown, like, I remember for like ages since TikTok started, I had more followers than him. And like now he has like double my following overnight. And that's literally from being passionate about what he does. So yeah, I would say right now, he's someone I'm loving. Like, I'm not even a car person. And I tune
in. His energy, I'm sure, is just mad.
It's like, even he just lights up when he's talking about cars. And you can just see that. Like, and the thing is that he's not even someone who's like making loads of money from content creation, because he's very new. It just happens that he's just grown rapidly. But like, now the offers are coming in and I'm so happy for him. But even if there were no offers, no nothing,
he'd still do it.
He'll still do it.
Yeah.
He'll still do it because he loves it that much. So
Tommy
Music on TikTok.
Passion over everything. That's it.
Yeah.
Amazing. Look, thank you so much. I could speak to you all day.
Thank you for having me.
It was so much fun. And yeah, excited to see where everything goes.
Thank you.
Unboxed with Jordan Schwarzenberger is a Listen original in partnership with Arcade Media. The exec producer is Amber Bateman, the senior producer is Lucy Hunt, and the senior digital producer is Alice Tilley. Unboxed is recorded at PRL Studios in West London with the support of Michael Kalasinski.